south of the border, down Mexico way. That's where I fell in love when the stars above came out to play. And now as I wander...
Hello there, all you expat wannabes. I'm Johnny Mueller, and you're listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America, the show that tells you just what it's like to live, work, play, and or retire down here in Latin America. It's a mix of the good, the bad, the ugly, and the great, and it's all right here, so let's get started.
All right, you know, I talk a lot about health care here in Latin America. Why? Because it's on the top of the list for expats with a plan B. I mean, look. Most people who are smart and astute enough to know they got to get the hell out of Dodge sooner or later are most often over the age of 50. Sure, there are plenty of astute young gringos in their 20s and 30s and 40s who want to get the hell out of Dodge, but they just don't have the means yet, or they haven't got their act together and are working on it. They're not the ones thinking much about their health because, you know, when you're in your 20s and 30s, you're invincible, right? But it's the gringos and expats over 50. They know they have to have a good health care plan and some great healthcare providers, because once you hit 50, it's downhill from there. Sure, you can slow down the process. I've done that. Just being here in Latin America does wonders for your eating habits and therefore your longevity. But in the end, you know, as Jimmy Morrison said, no one here gets out alive. And he checked out at 27. So that's why I spend a lot of time talking about healthcare, doctors, and clinics here in Latin America. I even wrote that 100-plus page report. You could call it a book. Healthcare in Latin America for Gringos and Expats, which you can get. And here's a plug by going to www.theexpatfiles.com and clicking on Johnny's Healthcare Report. In fact, it's new and revised as of just a couple of days ago and includes all the latest and greatest on stem cell treatments here in Latin America. In fact, I've spent an inordinate amount of time checking those places out simply because some of the members of my own family have slowly but surely destroyed their own health with the All-American Diet, along with the couch potato exercise plan and all the stress and anxiety you get from being on the first world treadmill. I'm sure a lot of you listeners have family members that are ticking time bombs too. So I have spent a lot of time researching umbilical, otherwise known as mesenchymal, stem cell therapies, doctors, and clinics here in Latin America. And again, if you want the information on stem cell clinics that I've come up with, send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. I'll ship it off to you. Speaking of emails, since I started talking about stem cells, stem cell clinics, and doctors, well, in the last few months, tons of listeners have requested that information packet. And they send me emails like this one from Tim. He says, Johnny, regarding stem cell clinics you've mentioned on your show, I know there are some in Mexico that you recommend, and I think I heard this past fall that you were going to go to one yourself on the west of Mexico in Puerto Vallarta. I'm curious, with all that stuff you've been saying about safety in Mexico right now, would you still recommend going to one of these clinics? Thanks for everything, Johnny. Signed, Tim. All right, Tim, good question. First of all, I'd like to say I only recommend one stem cell clinic in Mexico, not a bunch of them. Though I'm sure there are many more good ones. Who has the time to check them all? Every Latin American country has many of them. And the problem is how to find a good one, because down here in Latin America, there's very little regulation. There is no FDA, which in the end is a very good thing, because that's how alternative medicine clinics ended up south of the border. So as far as my investigation, I've only had time to check out and recommend a few different clinics. After all, when you find something good, you stick with it. And one of them's in Puerto Vallarta, Mexico. And man, is it high-tech and first rate. In fact, if you go on their website, they've put together some very excellent YouTube videos that actually walk you through the lab and the procedure and the equipment they've got. So you can see it's all new, first rate, very high tech and super hygienic. And it's also the least expensive of the clinics that I've checked out. Because, you know, the cost of getting the treatment's all over the place. Anywhere from $5,000 to $25,000. By the way, if you're new to the stem cell thing, there's just massive amounts of information out on the internet. And just like any treatment, there's pros and cons. So you wonder, how can you sort it all out? I've done that, but not out of the goodness of my heart. I did it because a couple of my close family members are falling apart. Of course, they've got no one to blame but themselves, but that's the American way, right? I'm all for people having the right to do anything they want to their bodies or put anything in their cake holes that they want, as long as they don't make me pay when they end up needing medical treatment. And that's one thing I really hate in discussions about national health care, with the do-gooders always saying, healthcare is a human right. Next thing they'll be saying, internet is a human right. Guess jeans and Nike shoes are a human right. And a trip to Disney World's a human right. And Netflix is a human right. And you know, it would be a different story if people were conscientious and took care of their health and ate a proper diet, but they don't. So why should I pay for the consequences of their bad choices? Same thing with rapists and child molesters. I say chemically castrate them. That should be a prerequisite for becoming a priest. So go ahead, call me heartless, call me cruel, call me a dickhead. Just imagine if I was king for a day. I'd probably get poisoned by lunchtime. But I digress, as usual. Where were we? Oh yeah, stem cell clinics. I know for sure the one I recommend in Puerto Vallarta and in Panama have websites in English. And man, they're excellent. They're very complete. YouTubes and all. But back to Tim's question about Puerto Vallarta. He's saying, is it safe to go there? Considering all that's been happening in Mexico over the past couple of years? Well, Tim, if you've been listening to my show lately, as far as Mexico, I don't recommend it as your Plan B destination. But I also say all the time, they've got great cheap vacation package deals to places like Tulum, Cancun, Playa del Carmen, even Puerto Vallarta, which is a beachfront vacation town. And the area of the city the clinic's in is very nice and upscale. In fact, they've got a YouTube video with some footage that shows some American patients landing at the airport, getting picked up in a taxi, and they interview this couple on their way to the clinic from the airport. You can see it's nice, modern, open. It's a tourist area, an area with no ghettos, no gangs, at least none apparent. No cabrones with neck tattoos. Of course, that's not true a couple of neighborhoods away, but you'll find throughout Mexico with all the foreign tourist spots, they're all sort of little upscale islands of stability, at least for the time being. And if you stay in those areas, you're generally safe. And the bad boys and girls, the gangs and such, are not living or hanging in those neighborhoods, but right outside the tourist spots. All bets are off. But just flying in to a resort or vacation area for a short time, or for a couple of days necessary for the stem cell treatments, there really should be no problem as long as you stay in the designated areas. Just don't go wandering off the beaten path. And you know, as far as Mexico goes, in fact, all big cities throughout the world, including in the U.S., you don't just decide to walk your dog at 11 at night. Unless, number one, you live in a gated, guarded community, and number two, you're walking your Rottweiler. So anyway, Tim, fear not about going to that particular stem cell clinic in Puerto Vallarta, Mexico. Oh, and Tim mentioned the fact that I personally, that's me, Johnny, am taking my own family members to that particular clinic. Here's the story on that. It was on my agenda way back in August. Then my mother fell down and broke her arm in three places. She's in her late 80s, so she's doing physical therapy and all that. Had to postpone the trip. She recovered from that and we rescheduled for early December. And then, right before we were going to go, she had a little fainting episode. The doctors in Chicago checked her out, found out she had a damaged heart valve, was leaky, so they replaced it just a few weeks ago. So now she's recovering from that, coming along fine. As of now, we're waiting for the all clear. Since they gave her a temporary pacemaker, they're watching her a bit. So when we're over that hump, I'm going down with her and my two brothers. One of them who's loaded with heart stents and he's in his late 40s. And the other, almost 60, overweight, arthritis, high blood pressure, terrible diet, on 8 or 10 prescription medicines, you know the drill. Now he's looking at a joint replacement or two, with a number of his sports injuries coming back to haunt him. So the next stop, before they do any surgery, the stem cell clinic. Don't worry, I'll keep you posted and give you the play-by-play on that. All right, now, staying on the healthcare issue. You longtime listeners have heard me say that every single Latin American country has a so-called national healthcare system. And most all of them are pathetic disasters. Though I still get listeners asking me, what about Colombia's national healthcare system? Or what about Ecuador's or Costa Rica? The truth is, those three countries, and probably Chile too, have the best national healthcare systems, but that's not saying much. They're second, even third rate compared to any private healthcare plan. You're still looking at long lines and impossible waiting times. Scheduling an appointment with a doctor could take weeks, even months, unless, of course, it's an absolute emergency. And speaking of emergency rooms at national healthcare hospitals, well, here's a test. Walk into a national healthcare emergency room and take a whiff, and you'll know in a second you don't want to be there. Oh, but they're good at trauma and broken bones and such, because the emergency rooms in public national healthcare hospitals are filled to the brim, balls to the wall, with accident victims. The most common emergency room patients being victims of motorcycle crashes. Why? Because they drive like maniacs, often three and four on a bike. They run red lights regularly and weave through traffic, drive on sidewalks, and go the wrong way down one-way streets. Yep, it's an exercise in Darwinism. So then why do they always end up in public national health emergency rooms? Because 99.9% of people who drive motorcycles don't have health or vehicle insurance. In fact, more than half of Latino motorcyclists don't even have a valid driver's license. And it's all about the money, you know? So if they don't even have the money to go take a driver's test, they're never going to buy private health care insurance. It's just not a priority. So then when you talk about national health care hospitals, what are they good for? Well, emergency room trauma victims. That's about it. Turns out national health care doctors are really great at trauma. So then what do you see when you walk into those emergency rooms? That is, if you can get over the smell. Well, you see patients who are victims of motorcycle accidents, chicken bus accidents, farm accidents, accidents in the workplace, gunshot and knife wounds. Basically, a lot of people who are really hurting, standing around hugging the walls because the seats are all filled. And there'll be cracked windows, dirty walls and floors, water stains from leaky ceilings, burnt out and flickering fluorescent tubes about to die, and bathrooms with no TP, towels, or even running water. Those are the usual suspects. Then you've got the so-called higher-end national healthcare systems in namely Costa Rica, Ecuador, Argentina, Colombia, and Chile. So then if they're at the top of the heap, what are they like? Well, they're pretty bad, but become just barely acceptable. When a new president or administration comes in, they always promise to inject money into and spiff up the national healthcare system, which none of them or their family members would ever dream of utilizing themselves. So then, every couple of years, there's a big injection of money and things are spiffed up. A coat of paint, changed light bulbs, new equipment. But it's still, you know, operated by government, which is the kiss of death. Think about the bureaucracy. In government, there's always more clerical people than doctors and nurses. Think of the government offices up by you. Think of the clerical workers and the mind-numbing, useless work they perform. They really have no interest in giving you the service you deserve. They just want to get their paycheck and get out of there. So, bottom line, however bad, sluggish, and frustrating government services are up in the States, it's worse than that down here. That's why it always irritates me when I read blogs and articles from places like AARP and International Living. They say, retire cheaply in Costa Rica, Colombia, Ecuador, and get on their national healthcare system. Yeah, right. That's the teaser. I'm sorry to have to tell you this, but even the so-called top-of-the-line national healthcare programs, like in Canada and England, UK, they're bankrupt and have deteriorated to such a state that almost everyone, except people who don't get sick, complain about them. So you've got people in really good health who don't use their services much. They're the ones that don't complain. But once you're stuck in the gears of the system, man, look out. Now, you've heard me say many times that national health care, just like socialism, is a very good idea that works in theory, on paper, in principle. But because of human nature and the fact that we're all different, it never works in practice. It just doesn't. Not to mention everything the government touches turns to shit. And I don't have to tell you how frustrating it is talking to people who say that national health care is the way to go, a human right. Though, sure, I'm 100% in agreement that the way private insurance is run in the States, with corrupt big pharma in bed with the insurance companies, controlling prices and lobbyists in that cesspool, Washington, D.C., the whole thing's beyond out of control. That said, it's an absolute certainty, if and when socialized medicine is implemented in the United States, it'll truly be more disastrous than what we have right now. Big pharma and the insurance industry will still have their hooks deep into the system. You think they're going to give up all those billions in profits? The new laws will certainly be written in their favor by their lobbyists. Congressmen will get their payoffs, as usual. Meanwhile, JQ Public will have to get ready to take it up the keister again, because it's coming. Oh, and for those of you who still believe that the Canadian or British national healthcare system is the gold standard, well, today I've got a little surprise for you. Sure, you have to read everything and then develop your own opinion, but don't just read articles. Listen to people who've got boots on the ground. Listen to the real stories out there, not just hearsay. And that's why today I'm going to make a little departure from what I usually do on this show. As you know, I almost never interview anyone. In fact, I think I've only done that once in 920 shows. You might remember maybe 5 or 6 years ago, I interviewed a tax guy, an expat tax expert. Sure, he had a lot of good information and things to say, but his presentation, it was so dry, it was like sandpaper. After that, I said to myself, no more interviews on this show. But today, I'm going to break that rule just slightly. I'm not actually doing an interview. I'm just going to play for you a part of a very recent interview from one Katie Hopkins, a British broadcaster and columnist who prides herself on going to places others won't go to report the truth from the road. She's a real boots-on-the-ground lady. She's slept on Skid Row, dodged hand grenades in no-go zones. She's followed illegal European migrants from Libya to Calais in France. She's watched them game the UK social safety net and welfare system. And being a British citizen with her family in the UK, she has occasion to use the national healthcare system. The following is what she has to say about it, and what she has to say about Americans who think a national healthcare system based on the British or Canadian model is the solution. So listen up and pay attention. You know, these British accents aren't so easy to follow. Here goes.
Yeah, I mean, God, watching Americans be sold this myth of socialized healthcare, you know, watching Bernie and Kamala and all the rest of them stand there and basically, you know, open their wallets and just kind of throw cash at people. Look, $20 an hour minimum wage, oh, socialized healthcare for all, free this. You know, it's bonkers, but also you want to say, I tell you what, come with me, Kamala. Come on, Bernie, come sit with me. And I tell you what we'll do, tomorrow morning at 8:30, because 8:30 is when my doctor's surgery opens, and I know that. And the reason I know that is because if I have a sick kid in the night, at 8:20, I need to be holding my phone, ready to start dialing, to try and get in the wait line, to try and get a receptionist to pick up who will be rude to me and want to know what's wrong, and try to beg for an appointment to be told there's none for 3 weeks. You know, I have ways of obviously getting around that. I can have private health or I can lobby. You know, if you're just a regular mum with, you know, a job to get to and not much income and a struggle, you're not getting a doctor's appointment. No way for your kid. No way. And we've just had, so the exchange point for socialized healthcare is rationing. So our old people here are told, no, you can't have a new hip. So if you're now over 75 in the UK, you cannot have a new hip. It's not worth it. If you've got cataracts, you can't have your eyes fixed anymore because it's not worth it. You're not a priority. If there's cancer fixing, there's drugs that will make you live longer if you have cancer. You're not allowed them because there's an actual mathematical equation for the quality of life years remaining, QALY. And if your quality of life years remaining costs more than 50K a year, you can't have that drug. So these are the things I could tell them in a, without political persuasion, just in a rational way. These are just the truths of a socialized healthcare system, is acute rationing that is without humanity, assessed by the quality of life years you've got left. Doesn't matter if you've got a 2-year-old, you don't get that drug. So that's the NHS. Now, do the other people that work in it, amazing. Yeah. Do our ambulances occasionally scoot people off the road, save their lives? And are those doctors and nurses, you know, brilliant people, completely? But are they overwhelmed to the point where they are suicidal? Yeah. And will our leftists acknowledge that mass immigration has made our National Health Service an international health service where taxpayers like my dad, who's 72 years old, he's paid into the system all his life. And he took a fall the other day. He was told it was 3 months wait to be seen by a doctor. And when he saw the doctor, they said, well, you're old, you have to expect these sorts of things. And he's still not walking properly now. He's never, ever used the National Health Service all his life. And now he's told, well, you're old, you have to expect this stuff. And he doesn't get treatment. So I guess that's just a sort of human mum / granddad story of what the truth is. And so that's why when I see Bernie and the others pretending, I just wish... You know, you just wish you could bring them home with you for a few days and show them something else.
All right, meet Johnny again. You know, many years ago, before I lived in Latin America, I moved to the UK. And, you know, I used to say to myself, man, these guys have worse diets than Americans. Bangers and mash and mushy peas in the morning. Bangers are these really fat sausages that look white. They've got so much fat in them. And the Brits, you know, aren't big on exercise either. And I used to say to myself, man, here's a society with national health care whose older people are just in terrible shape. I wonder how that's going to play out as the years go by. Well, now we know. And even back in 1988, 89, and 90, when I was there, they had an open-door immigration policy for all their colonies, like India, Pakistan, the Caribbean, and African colonies, where they made a deal with these countries when they gained their independence that their people would always be able to visit the UK without a visa. And man, has that policy come home to roost. In fact, I read somewhere just recently that only around 35% of Londoners were native-born UK citizens. And of course, you probably know the mayor of London is a Muslim. And if you're wondering how that happened, it's because of the population distribution. Well, to quote from an old 1960s hit, "You got your troubles, I've got mine." So then as for national health care, it's a good ideal with a fatal flaw. That being, the government runs it. And we know it's an absolute fact, everything they touch runs exponentially over budget, becomes a bureaucratic nightmare, a cancer that just keeps growing, and eventually turns to In fact, in my entire life, the only people I've ever heard say good things about government, I'm talking about in today's world, not my parents' world, are people who work for government. Then you've got guys like Bernd Bernie, who's never held a real job in his life, except in government, telling you and me, who've actually got our hands dirty, getting down to business in the working world, telling us how to live, what's good for us, and whatever we've got going for us now can be done better by government. And that's why me and so many others who've been around the world, visited many other countries, seen what it's like elsewhere, and realized the U.S. is no longer exceptional, but rapidly self-destructing. We know it's past the point of no return. It's not coming back. And the only alternative to going down with the ship is to get the hell out of Dodge while you still can. So I'll ask that most important question again. How's your plan B coming? It's your insurance policy, you know. And when the feces really does hit the ventilator, what you gonna do without a plan B? Dial 911 like 10 million others? Or maybe you think because you're a prepper, maybe you are, you could hunker down in the basement for a couple of months and wait it out. Good luck with that. It's always been my idea that becoming a prepper is kind of a practice run for having a real plan B. But you'll see in the next few years, it won't be enough. In fact, it'll make you a target for all those neighbors of yours who are not preppers. But you knew that already. You saw the movie or the Twilight Zone episode. You boomers out there will remember that one. The guy that built the fallout shelter in his backyard. Remember that one? And all his neighbors thought he was nuts. They laughed at him. Then the air raid sirens went off and the nuclear scare came. And guess who tried to beat the door in on that fallout shelter? You know, even way back when, I think it was like 1962, good old Rod Serling was way ahead of his time. Too bad the guy smoked 5 packs of cigarettes a day and went out the hard way. The real hard way. Oh, and by the way, down here in Latin America, they don't even have a name or a phrase for the word prepper. Because, you know, naturally, it seems like all Latin Americans have a plan B and they don't even know it. Because you see, every Latino, and I mean every Latino, has a first cousin, uncle, grandma, brother, some close family member that's got a little finca or a farm. So if there's any kind of national disaster at all, earthquake, tsunami, hurricane, flood, insurrection, well, you just hop on a chicken bus and head to Uncle Tulio's house. Yes, come hell or high water, the chicken buses will be running. So you spend a couple of weeks at the farm, or however long is necessary. Play hide and seek with the driveway chickens. The question is, how many of you up there in Gringolandia have that kind of close relative out in the boonies that'll take you in? I bet not one in 20, maybe 50 gringos has that kind of connection. And even if you do, the question as to whether they'd take you in or not's another thing. And remember, here in Latin America, no one dies of exposure. Why? Because it's mostly temperate climate, no ice and snow. Meanwhile, up in the States and parts north, like New York and Chicago, Detroit, etc., every year there are reports of dozens of people who die in their apartments because somehow the heating wasn't working or they didn't pay their bill. It's mostly old, forgotten, retired people, too, who don't have any close relatives to speak of. Sad, but true, but that doesn't happen here in Latin America. Not just because there's no snow and ice, it's because families are much tighter. And old people don't live alone. They live with their families. Up in the States, that's a rarity. All right, speaking of getting old and retiring, we've got this email. Comes from Les. He says, "Hi, Johnny. I'm a little bit excited after hearing your advice on not wanting to wait until your full retirement kicks in. I checked the Social Security website for my own case, and the payoff has gone up slightly. It's now around $2,000 a month if I retire on my birthday in just 1 month. Based on what you're saying, Johnny, I think that $2,000 a month is not bad for living in the Altiplano region of Guatemala or elsewhere south of the border. Though obviously it would be double if I wait till I'm 70. But who wants to wait till they're 70 to retire? Are the people crunching those numbers effing nuts? In the end, Johnny, I might be coming to your seminar sooner rather than later. I definitely will be coming because I'm ready to get the hell off the treadmill. So thanks and keep the great info coming. Signed, Les. All right, thanks for that, Les. You know, what he's referring to, everyone, is the fact that I always recommend to take your Social Security when you hit 62. Of course, if you let a few more years roll by, your payout increases. But in the end, if you crunch the numbers, if you don't start taking your dough at 62, it'll take a couple of years of collecting to make up the difference. And you're still not considering the uncertainties of the future and inflation. And, you know, we're heading into some bleak times that could wipe out the dollar. Plus, if you wait to 70 before you take your payout and retire, well, you may not be retiring because many people don't actually retire. They just move on to something else, but they still collect. So what if, let's say, your health is pretty good at 62, and when you reach 70, you're all screwed up? Because, you know, after you hit 60, things start falling apart all that much faster. What's the point of having a couple more $100 in your pocket every month when your health's not good enough to enjoy it? Hopefully that won't happen, but hey, you never know. Besides, let's say you're 62 right now, and you decide to wait till 70 because you get a bigger payout. That's 8 years from now, and man, it's going to be a completely different world even 2 or 3 years from now, and it ain't going to get better. And the dollar? It's almost certain to be a piece of toilet paper by then. However, I really do believe, even though the U.S. government is bankrupt and they say Social Security is bankrupt too, that you'll get that payout. They'll just print more money like they always do. Of course, since the U.S. government is following the Zimbabwe School of Economics, I wouldn't count on having any meaningful savings in dollars. So that's why my advice is take the money right away as soon as you qualify. And of course, the only way a Social Security check is going to allow you to live a real first world life is if you get the hell out of Dodge and come to Latin America or another third world country where you've got tremendous purchasing power still. And yes, Les, if you move to the Altiplano, $2,000 a month will allow you to live an absolute first world middle class style life without skimping on anything. Whereas $2,000 a month in Cleveland or Chicago will put you squarely in the ghetto or a white trash neighborhood in a high crime district. Is that your idea of getting old and checking out? You've been listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America. If you need some help with your own Plan B, we can schedule a one-on-one phone or Skype consult. Just send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. And if you want to get on the waiting list for my next week-long Expat Insider Seminar in Central America, where you're guaranteed to get a 2 to 5 year head start on your Plan B, send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. Nos vemos.